It was a little over 2 years ago that I started doing Grease Spot Radio. We've covered interesting topics and got to view the way international and the world from different viewpoints. I've always enjoyed doing them. And for the 8th anniversary of Grease Spot Cafe, I have a very special guest. He was the third trunk coordinator of the Way International during the biggest expansion of the Way. He also served as core coordinator. We talk about the last days in the life of VP Werewolf, and then through the reading of the passing of the patriarch, and on to the events that led to the 37-page letter sent to the Board of Trustees in early 1987. We did this interview in March of 2008. It is raw, honest, and riveting. Enjoy. The 37-page letter that you guys put out in February of 87, I think it was, February of 87. Now, let's backtrack to leading up to that, because you had left in December, I believe it was.
December 86, yeah. Yeah.
Want to give a little background what led up to your leaving?
Okay. Well, we'll go back to April of 1985. We were living in Lincoln, Massachusetts, and we're doing the Northeast region from there. And prior to Victor Paul Werewolf, going to Gartmore in Scotland to see Chris Gere, his valet and driver for a number of years, and an old crony for inside information going even back to 1972. But he stayed at our house in Lincoln for 4 days, he and Mrs. Werewolf. And we had one meeting. He was, you know, kind of slow and frail, but he looked okay, a little tired, bloodshot eyes. But that was kind of normal. The one was fake that he had lost to the ocular melanoma a year or so previously. And during that time, we spent a lot of personal time together, obviously. We had a nice big home there, the region headquarters, and we did things like we went out to see the movie A Passage to India, which was a kind of a horribly boring movie, but he wanted to see it because, you know, he said that it was a good feeling for what India was like as he remembered it when he was there in the mid-50s, and he wanted to see it. We went to a small theater in Lexington, Mass, that was really small, fully crowded, got hot. We had to leave early because he wasn't feeling well. So that's the kind of way it went. We just hung out most of the days. He rested a lot in the afternoons, and we had several long conversations about things. And he brought up stuff about why he was going to Gartmore to see Gear, and it was because he felt he was needing to give his last will and testament to somebody he could trust. And he said that there really wasn't anybody in the United States that he could trust. So he was going there because Chris knew him and loved him and would believe what he said. So we talked about different things, and he said a lot of various earth-shattering things, I guess, back at the time, and describing what he felt the spiritual condition of the Way Ministry was at that time in 85. And the current Board of Trustees was Martindale as president, and Don Werewolf, vice president, Howard Allen, secretary, treasurer, and things he talked about. A lot of things that were covered in Passing of the Patriarch, less details, lots of things that weren't talked about in Passing of the Patriarch. Then went over to Gartmore, spent that almost 3 weeks or so, close to a month over there, came back, and we met him again at the airport in Boston, Logan, and went on to the coach, and the physical change was pretty marked. He was severely jaundiced, of both the sclera, that's his eye, the good eye, his skin definitely, and very weak, could barely stand up. His voice was raspy and very weak, and he brought this six-pack of Moninger beer, which was a beer that I drank as a younger kid in Germany with my maternal grandfather. It was his favorite. And he asked me one time what kind of beer I liked from Germany, and I told him, so he brought that back, gave it to me, and was kind of crying, thanked me for the tree that we gave to Gartmoor and for other stuff, and was crying and said, "Goodbye, son, this is it." And then we walked off the coach, and they drove him back. Gear was in the coach, and Esmond, Peter and Christy Esmond, mm-hmm. were the, you know, aides or whatever, Mrs. Werwell. So then he went back to Ohio and died, you know, 3 weeks later or so. And then in August of 85, Core Week Rock of Ages, Gear was over there, and we had a conversation in front of my trailer that we lived in, where I asked him, you know, "What did Vic say to you? What did he tell you?" He said, "Nobody's asked me that. Not one of the trustees, nobody. You're the only one." I said, "Well, I know. He talked to me about a bunch of stuff and said some of the reasons he was going over there. That's why. What did he say? What did he know?" He said, "Well, I can't tell you everything, but you know I got to go after the Board of Trustees." And I said, "Well, I guess. I don't know what you got to do, but you can't do it now. It's Core Week in the Rock of Ages. I don't think it would work." He said, "Well, maybe you're right. Timing is important." I said, "Well, I would suggest you wait. Maybe do it sometime later when you can focus on it." Said, "Whatever." He said, "We'll be in touch," you know, always cryptic. So that was the end of that. Didn't hear much. The next thing that came up was in March of 1986 at the Word and Business Conference they had that year. And I was out there, and I got a call into the suite. Don Werwell and Craig and Howard were there, and they said, "You know, we've got something here that we need for you to read, get your comments on. It's really, you know, super secret," whatever that was, double secret probation. Anyway, so you know, read it, let us know what you think. So the conference is going on. They handed me this manila folder envelope. I took it back to my room and opened it up, and it was passing of a patriarch, of the patriarch, that Gear had written. And so I read it. It's the first time I'd seen it. Read the whole thing. It was the original version. I'm pretty sure it's what's been posted here. And then at the end, it was signed the way you see it signed on the site, you know, mm-hmm. by the three guys, Howard and Craig and Don. And so I had read it, and of course, there were a lot of things that were corroborated because of the things that Werwell told me in Lincoln before he went. And, you know, the way he looked when he came back, obviously, and there was lots of information on various individuals, you know, including the Board of Trustees and Vince Finnegan and other, quote, top leaders. And they asked me, "Well, what do you think?" I said, "Well, you know, it's pretty right on with the stuff that he talked to me about before he went. And, I mean, I don't see anything that's wrong with it. How are you guys feeling?" So, you know, they were pretty shell-shocked, but it was kind of business as normal. So they swore me to secrecy and said, "We don't know what's going to happen with this really yet, so we're trying to figure it out, and we want to know if you're willing to help and whatever, blah, blah, blah." So I said, "Yeah, sure." Went back to Massachusetts. We were living in Sharon at this time. We had moved from Lincoln. And the next month, April 86, is when Gear read Passing of the Patriarch for the first time at a Core Night, at a Wednesday night in the auditorium that was open then. And, of course, there was a hookup, and wow, talk about the poop hitting the fan. You know, everything was going all around the place, and, you know, I was in this position of knowing all this stuff but being sworn to secrecy. So there were phone calls, and then, you know, what's this, Gear had them call me, and I flew out to headquarters for, I was there for about a week trying to figure things out. They were a wreck. You know, it was pretty insane. And then came home, and then 3 weeks later was core placement, so I was in the May period of time. And it was about a year, you know, after Werwolf had died. And at the core placements, gear was there. And they did this, that's when they started this thing they called the Yak Twig. Johnny Townsend gave it that name, coming back to his little anecdote in the Way Tree class about when the baby yaks are attacked, the big yaks gather around, and the horns are out. And of course, that always meant their butts were sticking in the baby yaks' faces, but at least they were trying to protect them anyway. That's where it got. And supposedly, this was put together by Gear's straight call. He called the shots. He was calling all the shots. And based on what he said Werwolf wanted, and in that twig was, of course, Craig Don and Howard, Earl Burton, Art Poling, myself. Gear was the long-distance twig coordinator. Donna Martindale was also there to be with Craig, who was just a vegetable. And we were to meet every day, and Johnny Townsend and Ricardo Caballero, that's very important, they were in that twig. They later were made trustees, again, at Gear's instruction, based on him saying that that's what Dr. Werwolf wanted because of their hearts, blah, blah, blah. So that was the Yak Twig. And then they said, well, will you come back to headquarters? Because I really didn't want to go there. I had left in 84 for a number of reasons. And, you know, to get back out on the field, done being the trunk coordinator. And then he put that thing together. We were to meet every day and figure out how to save the ministry and get everything right spiritually. So we moved pretty quickly from Massachusetts back to New Knoxville, which was a drag. And I think we settled in there in mid-July sometime. But of course, every day on the phone hookup, you know, the Yak thing was happening, and Gear was telexing all the cryptic messages and revelations from Gartmore and all this other stuff. So we got back together in July, and then again, this is 86 now, met every day with that group. And then Gear came in for the Core Week in the Rock of Ages and read the Patriarch thing at the Core Week again. And it was just, I mean, it was a zoo. It was like the Tower of Babel, I guess, is the only way I could describe it. There's so much confusion and, you know, factions and people doing this and doing that and asking tons of questions and not getting many answers. And Gear was, again, doing his cryptic thing, you know, showing up here, showing up there. It was really insane. And then the Rock of Ages, I mean, boy, we did, you know, 21, 22-hour days the whole time just to try to keep the thing together. It was really a zoo and exhausting. And, of course, during this whole time, that Yak Twig was meeting every day. And sometimes it would be all day into the late evening, you know. Sometimes it would just be, like during the Rock and Core Week, we'd always have the early morning meetings starting, and then you'd have to go do whatever you were doing during those times. Same thing with the Rock. But every day we met and closed every night together. And, you know, we're discussing all these things, supposedly. But what was happening after that Rock, things settled down. We were still doing it. And for that month of, after the Rock through the anniversary, which is the first Sunday of October every year, we were doing this Yak Twig. And my core assignment was to be the core director and core coordinator at headquarters, and to oversee from the background, quote, according to Gear, you know, the U.S. trunk, since I'd done that. And what's his name? Duke Clark was the new trunk coordinator. Of course, as far as Gear was concerned, everybody outside that Yak Twig was suspect, and something was wrong somewhere. But we couldn't get to that right now. The first thing was we had to get the Board of Trustees spiritually clean and right and back to the Word and whatever else these things meant. And so, as I was working with the Corps, put a lot of emphasis on the Corps work program, you know, outside of meeting with the Yak Twig, I'd be out there chopping wood or killing chickens or cows at the Kip Farm. You know, I had quite a fun time. And I started getting these people flowing in about, well, you know, so-and-so sexually abused me or had sex with me, won't leave me alone, I don't want to do it anymore, I don't think it's right anymore, what should I do? And of course they knew that I had access because of that yak twig right there, and I'd go back and whomever it was, and there was only one other person in that yak twig besides myself that had never participated in any of the adultery, despite what you might have heard or whatever the disinformation has been through the years, that was Ricardo Caballero. So everybody else was fair game, and everybody else at various times I had to confront with that information and then get back to the people that were, you know, in need of some kind of resolution. Some, very few had a face-to-face with some of the individuals involved. Most didn't. It was a pretty, you know, wild time because there was a real toughness against it. They just didn't want to come out and admit that it's wrong, that adultery is wrong, and that sex outside of your marriage is just not right by the Bible. They kept trying to say all the references to adultery all the time are talking about spiritual adultery, spiritual whoredoms, you know, idolatry, going against the word, blah, blah, blah. So it was really frustrating, and it's got to the point where it was so widespread and so many people were, you know, jumping on this bandwagon now in their attempt to try to help get the ministry right, the trustees right, that literally during the month of September 86, there were times when there were lines of people outside my trailer there in New Knoxville waiting to come in to tell me what was going on. And then I'd go back to the yak twig and, you know, have these endless confrontations and conversations, and was at the end of one of those and talking about one of the in-residence 15th Corps women there that Martindale was, you know, busily pursuing and continuing to work on. They'd already had whatever sex they had had, and she didn't want to do it anymore. He wouldn't leave her alone. She didn't think it was right. So I said, what about this? And finally, he just, in the motorcycle shed, that was the day when he said, look, man, you got to back off on this. And I said, what do you mean back off? He said, you don't know how many times this has been done in the love of God, and it's ministered healing and wholeness to the people involved. And I said, what are you talking about? Hundreds, thousands of times? He goes, it was Dr. Wuerl that told me I had to loosen up in this category of life and living, or I'd never be a leader and lover of God's people. I'd never be a great leader or lover of God's people. I said, well, he was wrong, man. And you're wrong for doing it, and it's not right. You've got to do something about it. You don't have to, I'm not asking for a public admission, you know, or some public trial where you have to embarrass yourself and everybody else, but I think that the Board of Trustees needs to come out and make a firm statement that the Way International believes that adultery and the traditional understanding of adultery, not this spiritual thing you're talking about, is wrong. And we do not, you know, accept it, we do not practice it, and we do not, you know, subscribe to it. And he said, well, no, we're not going to do that. That's not right, blah, blah, blah. So what happened was I got a copy of, in that same month, in September, about the third week, a copy of John Shainhite's adultery paper, which I didn't even really know anything about. And Cummins wasn't in that yak twig. So I got this. Shainhite was in the research department. And one of the gals, a friend of a Corps grad, 6th Corps grad, that I had known from Michigan when we were there, gave me this paper because she had gotten it and asked me, well, you know, will you read it? What do you think about it? Well, I read it. It was pretty innocuous, pretty straightforward. And I took it to Walter Cummins, who was the head of the research department. I said, have you seen this? I threw it on the desk and I said, what are we going to do about it? It's pretty right on. It needs to be dealt with. I think he's right, you know. And he said, oh, well, that's just a bunch of legalism, you know. He's out of bounds for doing that. I said, what do you mean he's out of bounds? He's in the research department. He's dealing with an issue that's come up that is really a heck of a lot more widespread than I ever thought, and maybe than you know, or maybe you do know. I don't know. But something's got to be done about it. So he said, well, I'll take care of it. I took my copy of the paper back and didn't really hear much more about it. And there wasn't anything going on. And so it became more and more frustrating. you know, the thing was still like a zoo from that core week in Rock of Ages, because I'd been the trunk coordinator, you know, I was getting calls every day, tons of phone calls from limb coordinators out on the field, region coordinators, what's going on, what are you doing, what should we be doing, what do we believe, what don't we believe. It was severe crisis mode. I mean, it was just nothing but putting out the fires like Keystone Cops Fire Department. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just running everywhere. And, you know, the Board of Trustees, particularly Craig and Don, were just a wreck. I mean, you know, physically, emotionally, they were just, sometimes you couldn't, they couldn't talk, and let alone deal with some of these issues, and they were just overwhelmed. And it was overwhelming because it didn't stop. So the things going on in the business side of the ministry, like the outreach and, you know, all the rest of that stuff, was basically running on its own and, you know, trying to do this yak twig and coordinate the core and then, you know, oversee the trunk to handle the calls. It was really wild. I mean, it was average 20, 21-hour days. So what I did was, before the anniversary Sunday of that year, Wolfgang Schneider was in town, and he was heading back to Gartmoor on his way back to Germany for that anniversary Sunday. So I went ahead and handwrote 96-page letter to Gear, and that's handwritten, two sides of each loose-leaf paper. That's what it was on. And included a copy, in addition to the 96 pages, of Shane Heitz's adultery paper. And in that letter of 96 pages, I documented the activities of the yak twig and the calls I was getting from the people on the U.S. trunk in the field, and the thing about adultery with the people coming in there on the lines. And, you know, we needed some kind of firm documentation. Here's all the various issues that are coming up daily that nobody's dealing with. It included, you know, the what I call the psychic healings thing that Mrs. Wuerl was doing in the dormitory. She had people with cancer that were dying. She brought in this Amish guy from somewhere in Ohio, you know, and did some kind of herbal stuff. And then somebody else was coming in and out, and Naomi Townsend was involved with it. And it was just weird, you know, and this was going on. And there was this horrible stench from one of the rooms where somebody was at end-stage cancer of some kind, basically just rotting in the dormitory, getting this, you know, care, supposedly cure, from these Amish guy and whatever else Mrs. Wuerl was doing. What are we going to do about that? And what are we going to do about the adultery thing? And what are we going to do about getting these guys right? And it was a long letter, and the adultery paper. So I gave that to Wolfgang Schneider, who hand-delivered it to Gear when he went over there. And that was, like I said, the Friday before that anniversary Sunday of that year, which they went through their thing. Well, we continued in that yak twig, and it was going the way it was going. And then all of a sudden, in October, middle of October, I got a phone call from Gear late one night in my unit, and he said, "I got your package." He said, things are worse than I ever thought. He said, I said, what are you going to do about it, man? We need some answers. You're just giving us all this cryptic stuff. These guys are fumbling. Nobody can make a decision. And every time I'm wasting half my time discussing all this stuff about, you know, the sexual abuse and one thing after another, there are people that have committed suicide. I mean, I went at him. I told him, I said, you got to do something. There are dead people. There are people that are nuts. There are people that need to be hospitalized. There are people who need to be medicated. They need professional medical psychiatric help. He said, you know better than that, blah, 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 blah. I said, there is nothing better than that. You're not here. You know, what are you going to do about it? That's why I wrote you that stuff. He says, well, I'll get back to you. Keep going as things are going, and you'll get the telexes, and if I need to talk to you again, I will. I said, okay. So he hangs up. And then, all of a sudden, on these telexes, that's how many times he communicated by telex. We had a telex machine. We were set up in the basement of the old BRC, where the yak twig met around these tables every day. And the telex machine, you know, when it would go off, whoa, here comes some stuff. All this heavy revelation started coming in about needing to confront Dotsie about the healing stuff and the Amish guy. How do you know about it? We didn't even know about that. It's got to be revelation. And then the Shane Heitz papers. Well, I never talked to Chris about that. You know, Walter Cummins was brought in and asked about that. How do you know about that? Blah, 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 blah. Man, it just proves that he's getting revelation all the time. So finally he said, revelation, my butt. I could tell you what I did. I told him, and I admitted to the 96-page diatribe that I wrote and sending him the copy of the paper, and I said, this ain't revelation, man. Whatever revelation that we need or we have to have is going to be happening right here. But nothing's going on. You guys are just stuck on stupid. You're in, you know, vegetable category. We got to do something. Well, Chris is the one that's running the show. He's the only one that could trust. You really ought to blah, 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 run things through him. I said, well, I did. That's why I sent him the stuff. But don't tell me it's revelation when I know what I sent, I know what I wrote, and I see what's coming back. So they started talking back and forth to him, and then he started talking about doing this clergy meeting. And that was that clergy meeting in November, and the act to it was still running out of control, you know, stuck on that revolution of stuff I was telling you about. Mm-hmm. Then the clergy meeting came, which was a zoo and a half, and that was the beginning of the end, because he zoomed in and out, thought his life was constantly in danger, had a loaded 45 under the podium and also on his back, and had Qualty Harry and Blush Patrol people all over the place, and was bugging this and bugging that, and cameras here. I mean, it was insane. The guy was literally insane.
Yeah.
So during that clergy meeting time, of course, there were some people that walked out, you know, Mark Lewis and John Somer, Randy Anderson, Michael Martin, the guys that really took a stand and said that he was nuts, and it was pretty obvious to a lot of people there that this guy was out of his mind. Mm-hmm. And that the situation was beyond crisis mode. It was just like the aftermath of Hiroshima or something like that. So there were a lot of people that came up and talked to me and said, well, what are you going to do? We don't know who we can trust. What should we do? Should we send all our money to Gartmore? And I said, look, man, I don't know, but I'm not going to stick around too much longer myself. And that's after that clergy meeting. Gear goes back to Gartmore, and then we get this telex one day, tell Ralph that he's no longer a part of the Yak Twig. He's lost control of his mind. He's not in control of his mind. He can continue to work with the In Resonance core, but he's not going to be in the Yak Twig anymore. So when they read that, of course, it was read right as it came out. So I'm sitting there, and I don't know if they knew that beforehand, but at the time, I said, okay, well, I guess that means I'm out of here. So I packed up my, you know, books and stuff that were on the table at my little seat, walked out, and that was the end of November, and went back to my trailer and decided, okay, I'm going to be out of here. I'm not doing that. I'm not out of control of my mind. These guys are, and I'm going to quit. Mm-hmm. So I went back and I told them, and I didn't tell Gear first this time. I said, well, I'm going to quit. I'm resigning. And they said, why? What do you mean? I said, because this is bullshit. Oops, excuse me. I don't know if I could say that.
Sorry.
But anyway, I said, this is a bunch of crap. I'm not out of control of my mind. You guys are, and that guy sure as heck is, in my opinion. I'm not going to bounce around here and waste my time, you know, working out at the Kip Farm with the In Resonance Corps or something like that while this thing continues to get unravel and go nowhere. So I quit. I said, well, you just can't leave. We have to figure out how we're going to handle this. I said, well, I don't care how you handle it. I'm out of here. And, you know, then I went home, wrote my resignation, and sent it, gave it back into them. And so they said, well, we have to give you some time. You have to give us some time so we can figure out how to handle this. So then I was, for 11 days, the first part of December, last several days after Thanksgiving in November and the first part of December, we were basically under house arrest. I had three kids. The oldest was 7, and the other two were younger. And we had the Doberman Pinschers, two of them, and two armed gun-carrying bus patrol living in our unit for that time. You know, and they locked up our stuff in the OSC warehouse. We had no access to it. We weren't allowed to pack up what we had in the house until they gave us the go and figured out how we could do it. So finally, on the 10th of December, they came out and said, well, okay, you can have a meeting with the In Resonance Corps and tell them what you're going to do. And you know, we'll see how you want to handle it. So I said, I'm resigning for personal reasons and blah, blah, blah. I have that resignation note I wrote somewhere. It's stuck in storage somewhere. So, but that was what I said. It was personal reasons and blah, 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 blah. And we did that. And then on the 14th of December of 86, we left in the car. They'd given us this beat-up Chevy, 82 Chevy station wagon that I packed up with as much as I could in the back, the three kids in the back seat, my wife and myself in the front seat, and drove out of New Knoxville on December the 14th and came to Hopedale, Massachusetts to stay with some core friends that let us in. That was immediately their death knell. You know, they didn't really know what was going on. I mean, it was, you know, it was wild, but I had been in contact, and they're still very close friends. I'll always be thankful to them for allowing us to come stay with them. We had no place else to go, and they knew that as soon as we got there, that was it for them in the way. And of course, they didn't know what was going on. I had been in contact over the phone, but toward the end, the phone was bugged, so I couldn't say too much. But you know, they encouraged me, man, bro, get out of there, get out of there. I said, I'm trying, but, you know, they got us locked up in the trailer, the stuff locked up in the OSC, blah, blah, blah. So we got there, and then, you know, all the stuff started to hit the fan at New Knoxville. Now, something that's interesting is before we left, the night before we left, so it'd be the 13th of December, Ricardo Caballero and his wife, Sue, came to our little trailer. We sat on the floor in the bedroom of that trailer, and he said to me almost tearfully, he said, brother, I come to you as a brother, please don't go, you need to stay here. I said, no, I don't, I'm not here, I'm here because I was supposed to be in this yak twig and do this other stuff. Now you tell me that I'm crazy, I'm out of my mind, which we both know what that means. If I'm not in control of my mind, then something else is, huh? Mm-hmm. And he goes, no, that's not what it means. I said, well, nobody's told me what it means. I've asked. Gear hasn't said anything. Well, I talked to Chris. All right, so what does it mean? So you're too intelligent. You're relying too much on your intelligence, and it's getting in the way of you receiving the word and revelation. I said, what are you talking about? I'm too intelligent to receive word of knowledge, word of wisdom? That's ridiculous. He says, well, that's what he explained to me. I said, well, that's wrong. And I'm not leaving. I mean, I'm not staying. I'm out of here. And that doesn't do anything but make me more convicted that I need to get out of here. You guys are nuts. You're not in control of your mind. So that was the final of that conversation. And then we left the next day. So now we're into January 87, which we moved into our own house in Massachusetts, rented a place. And of course, all the poop was starting to hit the fan. First thing that happened was Joel Burke drove out with our stuff from the OSC warehouse and delivered it to that place in Franklin. So, you know, came and went the same day. Had a visit from Ira Hearn, who was still at the Kip Farm at that time, who was just out, drove out to Massachusetts and just wanted to talk, you know, a friend man to man. He was an older man than I. He was in his 60s at the time. Had a good conversation, but I told him why I'm not coming. Ellie Wilson was somebody that came out from headquarters while we were still living in Hopedale to talk. So it was like all these different people that were coming wanting to know, why'd you leave? What's going on? Because I couldn't say that before we left at New Knoxville. They didn't want to, so I did that scam about the personal reasons and blah, blah, blah. But of course, I was starting to say, here's what was going on, and I was telling them what was going on, telling them the facts about, oh, I had the J.E. Styles book, and Bullinger's Giver and His Gifts, and the Holy Spirit book, and B.G. Syllabus, and I had all this stuff that Pam Crayley, who used to be the historian for The Way, had given me so much great information, you know, and filled in so many things in the gap, because, you know, people were scurrying to cover their own butts as well as Vic's on this whole sex stuff and the drinking. And I mean, it was just, it was so weird, Pawtucket. I mean, it was like a soap opera of the worst magnitude that was unfolding in, you know, one episode after another, nonstop. Mm-hmm. I mean, genuinely sick psycho-emotional disorders. I mean, it was horrible, more than I ever imagined. And, you know, I'm going through this too. I mean, I'm leaving the way here. This is my life. You know, I was a clergyman. I'd been in, you know, high leadership circles, blah, 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 spent time with all these people and had been on the inside, so to speak. And so the phone rang nonstop. I was working selling frozen seafood door to door for the only person that would give me a job, another Corps grad in Massachusetts who was also banished as soon as they heard that he was working for me. So we'd be on the road every day, and I'm living at somebody else's house. The phone is off the hook. People from New Ohio are coming in. People from around the country are calling. I mean, it was insane. Yeah. So when we moved to our own house in Franklin, that just continued. Continued selling the seafood, and, you know, and then we got some threats. I had to go to the police chief in the town we were living in, showed him where I got one of those cut out from magazine letters, you know, saying the threats, you know, we know where you live and we know who your family is, blah, blah, blah. So I showed him that. So we had the safest house in our town for 6 months. The cops, I mean, it was really insane. So we continued to sell the, you know, the seafood, and the phone was ringing off. I was on the phone all day and all night when I got home from, you know, the selling stuff. And I was starting to get the invitations from people all around the country and even other countries to come tell us why you left. Tell us what's going on. We don't believe what they're saying, blah, 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 blah. And then things were starting to come out. You know, I'd get a phone call. They say that you were possessed to the hilt and blah, 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 daimons and this and that and this and that. And so I started answering some of those invitations. The first place I went, I think, was Rob Shipley, a Fifth Corps grad, got me down to Baltimore, Maryland, and did a meeting, and a lot of people showed up. And, of course, it was, you know, those days, there was that, I tried to, quote, unquote, teach something, but basically it was just questions and answers. And these people, you know, you had your rabid werewolf things, and you had people yelling at me and throwing stuff, and I'd be going back at their faces, and I'd tell them exactly what was going on and why they weren't told what was going on. So in February of 87, we had just been out of the way from the Knoxville for 6 weeks, I got a call from an old friend whose first wife was best friends with my wife at the time and known him from back in the Long Island days. And he was well known. He was a Fifth Corps grad, and his brother had been a trunk coordinator, and we'd gone a long way back, like I said. And he called to tell me that his limb and region coordinator, he was a area coordinator in the Phoenix area of Arizona. The limb coordinator, region coordinator at that time was Dave Standage, who was the Fourth Corps coordinator to boot before that, which I was in that corps. And so he said, well, you know, we just had this big meeting, and Standage said that you were born again of the wrong seed. And that's what he heard from Martindale. I said, oh, really? Well, I guess I'm up there with some good people, Spielberg, Streisand, Muhammad Ali. Thanks. He said, well, really, Ralph, I've known you for a long time. I can't believe this crap. I don't know what's going on, but can I come see you? You know, I said, sure, man, come on out. So I said, he showed up on that weekend of February 7th in 87, and I had all the stuff laid out, you know, that, like I said, the Stiles book, and then the first edition of the Holy Spirit book, The Giver and His Gifts. I mean, it's all verbatim. B.G. Leonard's syllabus to his Gifts of the Spirit class, which all the manifestation, everybody knows this, it's been on Grease Spot ad infinitum. So, but it was all new at the time to folks. Mm-hmm. So wow, okay. And we gave them the graphic, intimate details about what it was like at headquarters and what Martindale was into and Vic and blah, 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 blah. And he said, man, I knew something was right. And he said, I know you're not possessed, and I know you're certainly not seed, and, you know, what can I do to help? And he bought us furniture. I mean, it was a great thing. So he went back, and he's a close friend with Pat Lynn and John Lynn, because his family and the Lynns kind of grew up together. And so I got a phone call from Pat Lynn just a couple of days, you know, after that. So I spoke to Tommy, and you know, I got to come up and see you. Can I come see you? And I said, sure, but you know what's going to happen as soon as you do. She said, I don't care. I need to see you. So on Valentine's weekend, the next week, Pat Lynn came up to the house. This is in February of 87. And it was a very intense time and emotional time for her, because she was heavily involved in a lot of the illicit, you know, pimping, I call it, for Whirlwind and Emporia the whole time they were there. And she was a wreck, because she was overwhelmed with grief and guilt about that. And by the way, I'd just like to say that she's one person that has gone out of her way during these 20 years to find and seek out people she knew she hurt or contributed to, you know, bad damage, and apologize and offer her help and stuff. And she's been through the ringer, and I really respect her for that. She's still in that frame of mind today. But it was a hard time for her. It was a very hard time for her, and very emotional. And so when she finished that weekend, she you know, we took her to the airport and said, look, you got to help me get to John. You got to help me get to John. I said, well, you know, what does he want to do? I don't know, but you got to help me get to John. You're the first man of God that ever told me adultery was really wrong. I said, well, that's a shock and a shame, Pat, but yeah, whatever. So I got a call a couple of days later. Would you please come down to the Limb in D.C.? So I went down there and talked to John, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So he said, well, we got to do something about this. What are we going to do? I said, well, what are we going to do? There's nothing. The battle lines are drawn, man. The sides are taken. They're not going to change. They're not going to listen to anything. It's basically now an expose and try to tell them the truth. He said, yeah, well, you can't fight with them like that. We got to try to get a clergy meeting together, do something, tell everybody what's going on, lay the cards on the table without threatening the Board of Trustees, and let's handle the issues. I said, I don't think it's going to work. And that's when the idea of writing that 37-page letter came up. And the people who were writing that letter, Tom Reard and Robert Belt, came out from Arizona, because Robert was one of the first that came to me in that clergy meeting aftermath. Mm-hmm. Had talked about resigning, and we both talked to, you know, I'm quitting too. And he was, and it was very emotional for us. I mean, he'd gone back to 70 also and was around that long, good guy. So since they were close and lived in the same place and were getting a lot of heat because Standage was coming down on them, and they were forced to leave, you know, after he visited me, Robert came, and Robert was a, you know, a good, quote-unquote, workman of the word. He had taught, you know, classes at Emporia and stuff. And then Pat wanted Sue Pierce to come. Sue was going around the country. She'd been doing this already before, doing great meetings on dissecting athletes of the spirit, the video. I mean, she is one bright lady, and she was really getting down to some good stuff. And she had been told stuff by the trustees and Whirlwind because of her business acumen at the time about their plans and stuff like that. She was always sent around to put out fires, you know, like the Dove stove thing, and everywhere there was a problem. And she had left on her own. She didn't really have any kind of great assignment, but she was going around. She was well known. She had that little tape that they put together, Otheophilus, you know, mm-hmm. with Lynn Perrigo, that was well known. And she had been exposed as being an 11th Corps grad, so kind of people knew her. And she was going around doing her own thing. And Pat had been in touch with her. And so I said, yeah, she can come. And then I went down there. Tom Reard foot the whole bill. We rented some Holiday Inn someplace and in had a little conference room in addition to our guest rooms. And like I said, Tom paid for everything. You know, flights and everything going down there, the room, printing it up, you know, the whole thing. And they used the limb staff of the Way of D.C. to type it and everything like that as we wrote it. It took us about 5 days, you know, trying to figure it out. And it was interesting because Sue Pierce and I were on one side of the camera here about, well, we just got to tell it like it is. And the other guys were saying, look, we got to try for rapprochement here. You know, we need to, we can't be threatening about it. So we can't lay out all the dirt on VP and the rest, but maybe we can deal with the issues. Because if we attack VP, we won't get anywhere because, you know, that's Gear's whole thing and blah, blah, blah. So there was quite a lot of discussion on that. And Sue and I agreed, okay, we'll give it one last shot. And that's why that 37-page letter is, did nothing but quote Vic and, you know, core teachings and stuff like that, because we wanted to use their own words of their own idol to hang them. Mm-hmm. And here's the issues. So we glossed over the specifics about the adultery and the sex and the drunkenness and all this other stuff, just quoting sections of scripture about it. And again, coming back, using Vic's own words to try to say, look, if this is what we're talking about, this is our doctrine, then we owe it to the ministry and to each other to come together, have a clergy meeting. That was the whole point of it. We need to have another clergy meeting and lay all the cards out on the table, open it up for discussion, and blah, 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 blah. So we sent that letter to the trustees. John was the one doing all this stuff. You know, once it was written and we signed it, oh, and Sue Pierce, even though she was there the whole time, they didn't want her to sign it because she wasn't in a big-time ministry leadership position. Lynn was still full-time working for the Way as the Lynn leader of D.C., Tommy was an area coordinator. Robert had been a region coordinator before he resigned in December of 86. Of course, I was in that yak twig and all the stuff that I was doing. Pat Lynn, you know, was with John. And so they said, well, you don't need to sign it. She didn't particularly care, but I thought she should sign it. She was there and offered a lot of really good input. You know, like I said, she's a very bright woman. And but no, the decision was made, yeah, we'll just leave it this way. So even though she was there the entire time, she didn't sign it. And we sent that out, gave them 10 days to respond, or we were going to mail out some more. They never responded. So Jalvis went nuts and sent out, you know, copies to the universe, wherever he got his mailing list, you know, first in D.C. and to whoever asked for it. And then that tape in March of, I think it was March 27th, 87, came out from Gear. It was Gear and the Board of Trustees, Martindale, Werwell, and Allen, saying, you know, about the letter and that we were wacky. Please be so good as to cease communicating with me. And that's basically when we got excommunicated. John and Pat never resigned. They were fired on April Fool's Day of 87. They weren't fired till then. It was April 1st. Howard Allen went out there and fired them. And, you know, John, there's all stuff all over the internet where John says, you know, all the stuff that happened there. But it was no skin off our nose because we had resigned beforehand, so there's no question about firing us. They were the ones that got fired. And Tommy had, you know, been thrown out before because of what he did when he came to see me in February, and Robert had already resigned. So they got fired, you know, they didn't resign, they got fired. They kind of figured that would happen, but, mm-hmm. you know, that's when we officially got excommunicated. So the letter went out all over the place. Obviously, there was no clergy meeting, and then we had been going all around the place to, you know, by invitation only and stuff like that. We were doing different speaking things. Sue was doing her thing, John was doing his, I was doing mine. And so that was when the whole thing came up. John said, well, we really need to start something because we got to help these people. There's a lot of people leaving. We need to start our own thing and blah, blah, blah. And that's when the whole CES thing started. So in, I'm pretty sure it was in 87, in the spring of 87, we had these meetings at Bud and Bobby Reard's house in Indianapolis where we incorporated Christian Educational Services, as you know, a clearinghouse. We didn't, this was a pretty strong division already because, you know, we were having these phone hookups every week where it was, you know, Sue and Tom and Robert and Pat and John and myself, the ones who did that letter. Every week, Tom paid for these phone hookups, which were lengthy, 2, 3, 4 hours. You know, we'd be talking about what was going on and, you know, should we start a thing and blah, 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 blah. So the culmination of all that was, okay, we'll start a thing. And we incorporated it, but we had some strong debates again. And when we got to the meeting itself, John was saying he's the one that really was pushing this thing. And, you know, it was kind of the John Lynn show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the way John is, he just kind of took over the thing. And Robert was the first to kind of bail out on this. I don't want to do this, man. We need to get stuff together. We're just going to start the same mess all over again. And Sue and I had lengthy discussions about, you know, we've got to go underground unless there's a change of consciousness toward God and the Bible and what Christian ministering is. We're just going to repeat the same thing. We got to dump it all and start from scratch and see where the dust settles 10 to 20 years from now. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, we decided, we both knew, we got to go back to school. We got to figure out what we want to do. And if you're going to do a quote Christian ministry, then somebody or all of us has to get trained in an accredited, you know, academically set up, authorized seminary or school or something. Mm-hmm. We just can't go out and do what we're doing, because that's based and is presupposed on accepting all the Twi doctrine and the Wordable doctrine and everything else, which was all in question as far as we were concerned, and most of it downright wrong, none of it original, you know, besides all the psychosocial stuff that was going on with the adultery issues, the spiritual and sexual abuse, you know, the drinking, and I mean, it was just insane, as you probably know, and Greasepot has lots of great posts about it. So we incorporated that as a 501c3, and then the very next day, Sue resigned, and Tom continued to foot the bill, by the way, for all of this. He paid for, the, you know, the phone conversations, the filing of the documents, I mean, everything. It was at his parents' house, and I mean, he was really generous about that. He was supporting people, you know, that it was pretty amazing what he did. But it was starting to get us all burnt out, and Sue and I were definitely not into it, and we resigned quickly. You know, nominally, she was gone right away. And in May of 88, we had a meeting at the Airport Hyatt in Chicago. And that's when I stood up and said, you know, I'm not a part of this anymore, because I can't say that, you know, God has thrown me out of my Taurus and blinded me, telling me that it's His will that I preach or teach or do whatever it is you think I should be doing. I have no revelation like that. And until I can stand up in front of people and honestly say I do, I can't do this, let alone accept any kind of money for doing it. So I'm going to go get a real job and bye-bye. You know, see ya, be careful. And stopped traveling and all that stuff. And then in 88 is when I got a job working for a headhunter somewhere. So, I guess, did I answer the question?
Yes.
So, that's kind of how the whole letter thing came together.